Accession number 13426, Harold van der Wulf, reel 1.
Mr. Harold van der Wulf, Reel 1. Could you tell me when and where you were born, Mr. van der Wulf?
Yes, I was born in Bodmin in 1925 at a place called Prison Quarters, which later changed to Flaxmoor Terrace. It's just below the old prison.
And what did your father do for a living?
My father worked, at one time he was a clay worker, and then he worked in the mental hospital and was a charge nurse tutor.
Now, you've an unusual name, and I know you've been doing a bit about your family background. What did it come from?
Well, we always thought it came from Holland. But in fact, since I've been doing the family tree, I've found that my great-great-grandfather actually came from Copenhagen. And his name was then given as Thunderwolf, not Vanderwolf. And that's why I had a problem finding him. And his first child was called Thunderwolf when she was born, but van der Wulf when she was married. And all his, he had five children, and the other four were all christened van der Wulf. And we don't know why the name changed. And there was no E on the end of the name. Now, the E only got on the end of the name when I was christened. And with my, I got a twin brother.
Is that the only one in your family?
No, I had an elder brother who was in the Air Force, but he died in 1953 at the age of 31 with a heart complaint.
Now, could you tell me a little about your childhood in Bodmin? Was it comfortable? Were you well off?
Well, I don't suppose my parents were well off, but we had a very comfortable life, and I mean, I remember my childhood as being a very happy childhood. I was lucky, I had good parents. And I think we're very fortunate we've got good parents. They were very understanding, and I had good parents.
What schools did you go to?
I only went to what was known as the Bodmin Board School, which is now the county primary school. And I didn't pass me 11 plus, so I left school at just around about when I was nearly 15, I suppose.
That'd be about 1930.
No, 1939, because I was born in 25.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I'm adding it wrong there. did you enjoy school?
Yes, I wasn't a great academic, but I enjoyed school. Yeah. And in fact, I've always been one that makes the most of any situation. You know, no matter where I land up in, whatever I do, I make the most of it.
Were you interested in sport at all?
Yeah, oh yes, I was a very keen cricketer and played football. And we used to play shinty at school.
What's that?
Which is a form of hockey done with, like, walking sticks. but I played football for the school and cricket for the school. And I've played cricket all my life.
Did you play for local clubs?
Played for the St. Lawrence Hospital Club. And I was captain for 12 years, opening bat, wicket keeper, and played for them for a large number of years.
Now, before the war, were you in any of the boys' organisations at all?
Yeah, in the Cubs.
But not the Scouts?
Didn't go into the Scouts.
Any reason why not?
No, just didn't go into the Scouts. I think that other interests took over. I belonged to what was known as the Regnal League.
What was that?
Well, that's a sort of semi-religious, well, something like Talk H. It gives the all-round life. That's why it was called the Regnal Circle. And we dealt mainly with spiritual, physical, and mental things. So that you would have discussions 1 week, another week you would go out and do sporting activities, walks, and that sort of thing. And also I did a bit of local preaching with them when I was about 16.
Which church were you involved with?
Bodmin Methodist Church. Yeah, my father was Church of England, my mother was Congregationalist, and we became Methodist. And that was simply because it was the next door neighbour was a bit older and was able to take us to Sunday school. So we went to the Methodist Church, and I've always stuck with the Methodist Church.
Now, towards the end of your school time, the war was starting, and looming right, and so on. Were you very aware of what was going on in Germany during the years leading up to the war?
Not really, you see, because history at school, we hadn't barely reached the First World War. It's quite peculiar. I mean, nowadays, I get groups of children coming here to see me from the Bodmin Comprehensive School to discuss D-Day. And yet we were only up to about the First World War when I was at school. So we weren't really aware. I mean, we knew that there was a war starting, and that's about it.
Do you remember the day war broke out? Anything stick in your mind?
No, it doesn't, except that I think we all said, well, at least we won't be involved, you know, because we were only 14, 15 year old.
You thought it would be over then?
We thought it would all be over. Well, everybody said it would be over by Christmas.
And they hadn't learned the lessons then from that was the sort of thing they said in the First World War.
That's right.
Now, you left school in about 1940, yeah. And what did you go to do?
Well, I left school and went as an errand boy to Hepworth, the multiple tailors.
What did that involve?
Well, just going out on the bike delivering parcels and cleaning up the shop, the front, and all that sort of thing. And also training, of course, to be an assistant, shop assistant.
And how long did you do that for?
Well, I started with them in 1939, and in 1942, I was transferred from Bodmin to Wells in Somerset as an assistant. And I remained there until I was called up in 1943.
Now, so, how did the war affect you then during those 3 years?
Well, I was involved with the ARP in Bodmin.
Let's talk about that. What did that? How did you join the ARP?
Well, they were looking for messenger boys, cyclists, and we all wanted to do our bit, and there was that sort of feeling. Everybody wanted to do something, so I joined the ARP as a messenger boy. And that meant that if the air raid siren went, whatever you were doing, you left and you jumped on your bike and you went and reported to the centre, which was up at the old prison. And also you did one full night a week on duty at the centre. I always did Saturday night.
And what would you do on your night's duty?
Sleep, mostly. You're only there in case of an emergency, really. Yeah.
And were there any raids on Bodmin?
Oh, yes, we had a raid, but that was after I left Bodmin.
So this was just routine. Did you have to take many messages? I mean, were there many alerts?
Yes, we had a lot of alerts and used to run around all over the town. And eventually we went on the motorbikes. Yeah.
Did they teach you, or did you already know how
to ride? No, we just dumped on a motorbike until they got on with it. And I remember running out of petrol coming up from Lostwithiel, because I was riding in the wrong gear, and I copped it. I was called up in front of the commander and told off, told that if I didn't use the motorbike properly, I'd go back on the cycle.
How far would you have to go with these messengers?
About Lostwithiel was about the furthest, which is, well, I can't think of any miles Lostwithiel is, but 8, 6.
It's a fair cycle ride.
Oh, yeah.
But not too bad on a motorbike.
No, very good on a motorbike.
And did you have any other duties in the ARP?
No.
And what about the Home Guard? Were you in the Home Guard at all?
Oh, no. My eldest brother was in the Home Guard, which was then known as the LDV. But, I wasn't old enough to go into that.
Now, when you moved to Wells and Somerset, did you mind being sent, because you lived at home all your life, you were sent out there, it's quite a fair way.
No, it was only I enjoyed going, and I remember my parents didn't really want me to go, but my eldest brother said to them, look, if it's what he wants to do, let him do it. And it meant promotion, of course. And I suppose it was about one of the happiest 9 months. I was there for 9 months, and it was about the happiest 9 months I had. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I, of course, through the Methodist Church, in those days, you see, all your social life was centered on your church, not like today. And the first thing I did was report to the Methodist Church, and I was into the youth club, became secretary of their youth club, and played badminton, and won the club badminton championship, doubles, and it was very good. I had a good time there.
And were you in the ARP in Wells?
No.
Did you ever think of volunteering, or were you content to wait for your call-up? I mean,
well,
what did you feel about the whole question of going into the forces?
Well, I can remember when I went up for me physical at Bristol, I had to go, as I was living at Wells at the time, I had to go to Bristol for my physical. And I think the general feeling, apart from one or two chaps, was that you had to be A1. You know, there was no question of failing to be A1. And so you made every effort to make sure that you got through your medical. Because there was this feeling that when your turn came, you went, and you went quite willingly. A few chaps volunteered. I had one particular mate who volunteered and was in Normandy at the age of 17 and was killed. But, you know, he no need to have been there, really.
So you went for a medical. Did anything else, how did the sort of call-up work? Was the medical the first sign of it? You called up for your medical?
Yeah.
And then what happened next? You passed A1.
Well, I got through A1, and I think just 3 months later I was called up.
So what would that date be, roughly speaking, or the month?
Well, I think I was called up it was before I was 18, so I think it was about the January, and I was called up in the April of 43.
And where were you told to report to?
Gujarat Barracks at Colchester. I can remember getting out at Paddington and having to catch the underground to the other station, and I saw three chaps sitting in a corner looking absolutely lost and bewildered. And I went over to them and said, are you going to Gujarat Barracks? And they said yes. And they'd come up from Cornwall. Neither of them could read or write. And they'd been placed on the train at Red Ruth by their parents. They'd got out at Paddington and they were absolutely lost. So I said, well, come with me. And we went across London, and they said, well, you've done this before. I said, no, I've never been in London in my life. But, you know, I found my way across, took them with me. And they were three nice boys, but they couldn't read or write. And I was absolutely amazed to find that people couldn't read or write.
It's not what you were used to from Bodmin.
Well, that's right.
So what do you remember reporting in for the first time to Colchester?
Oh, well, we were met at the station and piled into a truck and taken to the barracks and told by some very pleasant sergeant that we were now in the army and that, you know, he was going to see that we made good soldiers. And we were put into sections. And actually, I enjoyed my training. It was for the first week you weren't allowed out of camp.
So, to look at it organised, what were your rooms like? Or can we?
Oh, in a big barracks.
They're yeah, old-fashioned barracks.
That's right, the old-fashioned, proper old barracks, like the one at Bodmin. And, you know, you were in, well, I don't know how many of this, we were in a room quite a lot. And we were in bed bunks, like, with, just straw to sleep on, you know, in a palliasse, as I think they used to call them. But, you know, the big thing you see was that you realise you weren't on your own. That whatever you had to face, there was a gang of you to face it, like you were all there together. So, but it never bothered me, it never worried me. And, of course, having been away from home for 9 months, That helped me tremendously when I was called up, because some blokes were quite upset and homesick. But I'd gone through that, you see, at Wells, so that it made life easier for me, really.
So let's look at your training through, say, a typical day. What time would your day start?
Well, 6 o'clock in the summer and up past 6 in the winter, so that we came up to the 6 o'clock reveille. And, well, it was parades and rifle drill and stripping down weapons. And
so what was the drill like? How did you fit in with drill?
Well, the marching, well, I found that no problem, no.
Did you understand why you had to do so much of it at the time?
Well, I think, yeah, we were told straight that you know, if you didn't do your drill properly, then you couldn't be a good soldier. And the object of the drill, of course, was to instill discipline, I think, mainly.
So you didn't kick against it?
Oh, no, we had one or two that used to, you know, grumble and moan. But, you know, as I said earlier, I've always been one that, okay, if I'm in a situation, then I've got to put up with it and make the most of it. And, in fact, I could never understand chaps who grumbled and moaned all the time they were in the army and remained a private. You know, and my one ambition was to go up the ladder and become a sergeant. Or
right, something. From the start.
That's right. That's right. I wasn't going to be remain a boy, you know.
So you had drill, foot drill. What about weapons drill, learning to shoot, for instance? Yeah. How did they take you through learning to shoot?
Well, you were taught how to look through, you know, the sight of a rifle and how to load it and the safety measures of loading.
What were they?
Well, never pointing the weapon at anybody and that sort of thing. And then you were taken on rifle ranges and taught to shoot at targets. And I was fairly fortunate. I became a marksman with the rifle, the Bren gun and the Piat gun.
What do you think made you a good shot with the rifle? What factor?
Well, I think the main thing was interest. Wanting to be a good marksman.
So it wasn't good eyesight or steadiness of hand, it was determination.
I think that was more to it than anything else, because I think most of us at that age had a steady hand and good eyesight. I think it was just, yeah, wanting to make the best of a bad job, if that's what you call being in the army, you know.
What about the Bren? What did you think of that?
Oh, a super weapon.
What was so good about it?
Well, the fact that you could get so many. Well, I mean, you could fire rounds very rapidly, or of course you could fire single shots, so that you could adapt it to suit the situation. It was a bit heavy. I think it was, if I remember right, it was about 28 pounds. But I mean, that's calling from memory. And when you're firing a Bren, you've got a number one and a number two, because the barrel gets hot and it has to be changed every so often. So your number two was responsible for loading the machine and for changing the barrel. So you went through, in your training, you went through the stage of being a number two and a number one, so that whatever job you landed up with, you could do competently.
Did you practice stripping it down a lot?
Oh, yeah. I was quite quick. I can't remember the times, but I was quite quick at stripping down and putting together again. You know, after with practice. But then again, that was enthusiasm and interest. Because, you know, I felt, well, I think at our stage, we never really thought we were going into action. You know, the war was beginning to lean our way a bit. And although there was talk about going to be an invasion, I don't think at that stage that we thought that we were going to be well enough trained to take part. We got a shock.
So there's a Bren, rifle Bren. What was the you mentioned a third?
The Piat gun, which is the platoon infantry anti-tank.
Did you do that in your basic training?
Oh, no, I did that when I was with the 1st Duke.
I'll come back to that then.
Right.
What anything else you did with your basic, any other weapons you were introduced to in your basic training?
No.
Not the 2-inch mortar or anything like that?
No, that came when I went to the Duke of Cornwall. You see, my basic training that we're talking about now lasted 6 weeks.
So What about bayonet training? Did you get any of that, or bayonet?
Not in the first 6 weeks.
No. So just learning to shoot with a rifle,
and the breath. And to do your drill and that sort of thing.
Did you do any sort of simple tactical stuff?
Not in the first 6 weeks. It was just route marches and short route marches, I mean 5 miles.
Did you have any trouble with that?
No, never had any trouble with my feet until I was in Normandy. And then I had a blister.
So, any other aspects of training in that first 6 weeks that you remember? How did the instructors treat you overall?
Oh, well, we looked on a lance corporal as a god. I mean, to us, a lance corporal was a god. There was no doubt about that in your early days. And a sergeant was a very frightening person. And I think we were lucky we had a good sergeant. I mean, he was very severe, very firm, but he got the best out of us. He had to, because at the end of 6 weeks, you see, you had a parade and each section was checked and the sergeant got merit marks and that sort of thing.
Were you shocked, or you come from a Methodist background? Did he swear at all?
Oh, yes. Yeah, but that never shocked me.
Was it your first experience of a lot of swearing?
Well, yes. I'd never been used to the language that I used to hear. But, I mean, you got that in the barrack room anyway.
What about bullying? Was there any of that by either the NCOs or the men?
No, can't recall having any bullying.
You wouldn't see much of officers during basic training, would you? Presumably?
No, just your, I suppose he was what was known as the section commander or something, a lieutenant. Never met the CO or anything like that, not in that first 6 weeks.
Were you learning how to prepare your kit for a kit inspection?
Oh yes, we had all that to go through. You had the kit inspection once a week. You know, properly blankoed and laying up your bed, because you had to make up your bed and your blankets had to be folded properly and squarely and all that sort of thing. But again, I'd come from a home, you see, where I had a mother who had varicose ulcers, and I'd had to do a lot of housework. And so chores like that didn't come as any problem to me. It did to some. Some found it very difficult to fold their blankets and make their bed, but I never had any trouble like that.
Now, what about recreations during the 6 weeks? You weren't allowed out in the first week. What would you do after that? Would you go into Colchester at all?
Yeah, went into Colchester and just looked around the town and that sort of thing. But in the 6 weeks at Colchester, I saw very little. Well, didn't see any real social life.
Were you teetotal?
I was when I went in, because I'd had a very strict upbringing. But and it was quite a long time before I even had a drink. But so I didn't go to pubs.
So at the end of the 6 weeks, you'd had your basic training. That was general service training. That's, you weren't actually with the Colchester the regiment.
No, the Essex regiment. you were in what was it called, a general service corps or something like that. Yes, something like that. And it was the same basic training that everybody got.
Did you have any choice as to which regiment you'd be posted to at the end of your training?
No, at that stage, they were deciding where you were going to go, and I think most of us thought we were going to land up in the Duke of Cornwall's, you know. And having watched the Duke of Cornwall's doing their 10-week course, march, that was the one thing that disturbed us, at the speed of their march as opposed to an ordinary infantry regiment. You know, the light infantry is very fast. And we used to watch these chaps doing their parade.
They were based at the barracks as well.
That's right, but the other end of the barracks. And the normal practice was that after 6 weeks, if you were sent to the Duke of Cornwall's, then you went across the other side of the barracks and joined the Duke of Cornwall detachment there for the further 10 weeks training. But when we were given our post, and we found that we were being posted to the 1st Battalion of the Duke of Cornwall's in an experiment for what was known as a recruit platoon. and 20 of us landed up at Ringwood in Hampshire from Gujarat barracks, and 20 from somewhere in Yorkshire, like Wakefield, somewhere like that.
And you were with which battalion? The first
battalion.
The regulars?
That's right. Which was originally the 6th, of course, because the 1st had been wiped out in North Africa. And the 6th became the 1st.
Now, what was your reception when you went there, the 20 of you?
Well, I'll tell you an interesting story, really. We arrived at the unit towards tea time and were lined up, and the RSM came along to welcome us. Now, he was a short chap, obviously getting on in years, obviously would have finished his service had it not been for the war. You know, he was one of these unfortunates, I think, who would have been discharged from the army, having served his 20-odd years, but the war prevented him from going. And he welcomed us to the regiment. He welcomed us to the 1st Battalion. He said that we would be known as the recruit platoon, and that we would be under a Major Northey. And then he said, well, I don't want you to unpack your kit because we're moving in the morning. We're not remaining here. So he said, just get your billy cans and go to the cookhouse for a meal. Now he said, when I dismiss you, I want Private Vandewulf to remain at attention and the rest of you dismiss to the cooking place, you know. Well, I nearly dirt bricks. Here was me, 6 weeks in the army, and the RSM wanted to speak to me. You know, what have I done? Anyway, the RSM came over to me and said, stand at ease. And he said, was your father known as Twodder Vandewulf? And I said, oh, yes. He was known as Twodder Vandewulf because he stuttered. Nobody really knew why they called him Twodder, but he was known as Twodder. So I said, yes, Twodder Vandewulf is my father. Well, he said, when you write your father, you tell him that you're here with Ginger Randall. Now, it turned out that this RSM was a corporal with my father in the First World War. So he said to me, he said, look, if you get any problems, you come and see me. And, you know, don't worry about things, come and see me. And which, you know, was quite remarkable, really. And then I went into the cookhouse, and a voice said, what the hell are you doing here? And this was one of my uncles from out at St. Maybourne. He was one of the cookhouse blokes. Yeah.
So you weren't alone at all?
No.
Now, what sort of a training program did they put you 20 through? Because this is a new thing.
The 40 of us.
40, sorry, yes. Yeah. The 20 from the other.
Yeah, well, the next day we went to the Isle of Wight. And we went to a place called Rookley, in the Isle of Wight. And we were in a big house, the 40 of us, with a sergeant and a corporal and, of course, the major. And we went through routine training then. That was fire drill, bayonet practice.
What was the bayonet practice then?
Well, you used to have to run at stuffed dummies and yell at them and stab them and pull it out and run on again and all that sort of thing, you know.
Did you actually practice bayonet fighting, as in, you know, with...
Yes, we were given shields to put on our bayonets, you know, because you didn't want to stab anybody. And it was just something that went over the end of it. And we used to, you know, go against one another practice, sort of try to stop the other's bayonet from coming into you. That was quite difficult, actually. Quite difficult.
Did you do a lot of bayonet work? Or?
Not too much, no. And it was just as well, because I never did any bayonet work.
Did you think it was a bit outdated? Or?
Well, I thought it was a bit gruesome. and hoped that, you know, that we wouldn't have to come up against any. But the corporal that was with us had been involved in bayonet fighting, and he told us it was, you know, it was very important that we learned it, because, you know, your chances of survival in a hand-to-hand bayonet thing was very small.